Give your tail, tentacle, or other appendages a wag in anticipation, because in this episode, I sit down with Laura Perkins of Laura Perkins Animal Behavior to talk dog training. We find out about how her career developed and what she's currently doing. She also gives some examples about working with some creatures most of us will only see in zoos. So grab your towel, because you never know what or who you'll come across when you hang out with the non-humans.
All right, so I am Kelly, and I am with Laura Perkins, who is the owner, creator of Perkins Consulting. Is that right?
Yes, Laura Perkins Animal Behavior. Yes.
Excellent. Okay, so as a quick background, Laura and I went to school together at the University of North Texas, and I went down the route of human management and autism and developmental disabilities. Laura has explored the wonderful world of animal training. And so we wanted to bring her on to kind of have a discussion about, as we've been promoting, the atypical, the kind of on the fringes areas of behavior analysis you may not be aware of or don't know as much as you should in this case. So just to start, Laura, if you could just give your kind of history, how you got to where you are now and that fun story.
Sure. Yeah. So I started working with dogs when I was really young. I was in 4-H and I always wanted a dog. And so I got a dog and got to join 4-H and did training through my 4-H project. So that's kind of when I started. I was 8 or 9. And so I did that all through school. And as I started thinking about college, I really thought I wanted to be a vet. And I worked at a vet clinic for a few years. And I went to undergrad with the plan of becoming a veterinarian, and did my undergrad in animal science at the University of Illinois. And while I was there, I kind of realized that what I really loved about animals was how they learn and the training process and things like that. So, but my undergraduate program didn't have a ton of behavior options. So I took a few behavior classes. A lot of them were more ethology based than behavior analysis. I decided I needed to go to grad school because I didn't get what I wanted out of my undergrad. So I learned a lot of really useful stuff. I learned how to shear sheep and give cattle injections and things like that. It's good. It's helpful when you're working with animals to know those things too, but it didn't answer the questions I had. So it took me a while to understand that what I was looking for was behavior analysis. I didn't know the name of it. This woman who worked at the ASPCA at the time actually directed me to UNT because she knew Dr. Jesus Rosales Ruiz. So she knew him from Clicker Expo, which is a animal training conference. And she was like, you need to talk to this guy. So I emailed him and didn't hear back, of course. And my mom was a teacher at a different college. And she was like, you need to just call him because that's how you're going to get a hold of him. So I did. I called him and they were about to have their first art and science of animal training conference. And he said, you know, if you really want to do this program, you should come check this conference out. It would be a good place to start. So I did, and I applied and I got in and started at UNT. And so that's kind of what brought me to behavior analysis. But even as I was applying for the program, I did not understand what it was. So I did the intro class online over the summer, the prerequisite class. And as I was doing it, I was like, I do know a lot about this stuff. I just didn't know the name of it.
I think it's fun because I think a lot of us kind of find ourselves in that position, going through undergrad of like all of a sudden the things that we've done either our whole lives or as we've started to like slide into a career path, we're like, oh snap, now it totally has a label. It makes so much sense now.
Yes, exactly.
Behavior analyst my whole life. Now I have, just terms for it.
Exactly.
Awesome. Yes. So one of the things you mentioned was you had to take the ethology classes. Can you elaborate a little bit more on what that actually is? Because I'm not as familiar with that.
Sure. So a lot of those classes were in the biology department. And we learned a lot about like fixed action patterns. We talked about Thorndike. There's a thing about, it's been so long that I don't remember the details of this very well. But things like, you know, the seagull will peck the red spot on their parents' chin to make them open their mouths, things like that. So it's a lot more of the like genetically driven behavior. It's interesting to me, but I really wanted more about like learning in your lifetime. So the ethology kind of studies like typical behavior trends across different species and things like that.
Sounds a lot more like
individual innate learning.
Yes,
it's a lot more
the respondent side of things versus like, hey, cool, what can we actually do with this thing that we have now?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's really, I think a lot of ethologists end up looking at like preservation of animals and wild species and things like that. So it's not really my area, but that's where I was like, this is interesting, but it's not what I'm looking for, you know? So yeah.
Sort of answers the question, but it doesn't quite scratch the itch for the rest of it.
Yeah. I really wanted to know more about how individuals learn and what makes that learning process easier and faster and better and things like that.
So with going to grad school and everything, you had your start with 4-H and doing some training there. And then you moved into grad school. And so then how did that develop further?
Sure. So, I also in high school did some agility, and that's where I was introduced to the idea of clicker training and shaping. And so I think that what I learned in that context was like the most helpful for grad school, as far as like jumping me into what we were doing there. So, the lab I was in was the Jesus's lab, or the Organization for Reinforcement Contingencies with Animals. It's kind of a mouthful, but it's ORCA. And one of the places where we got to do a lot of practice with our skills, our shaping skills especially, was the Herd Museum. So I think that is probably where I really developed my ability to do shaping and build behavior and those kinds of things. And that's probably been one of the more useful things in my career, because that's what we're doing over and over with our clients, is helping them learn how to shape behavior and build behaviors that we want. Does that answer your question?
Oh yeah.
I'm not sure I answered it. Okay.
No, it's kind of, you know, what do we do in grad school? And it's kind of fun because you can follow your coursework and you can go down and take the little boxes off. But if you take those chances to step out of your comfort zone, because I remember correctly, the Herd Museum had like lemurs. And it wasn't just your traditional like dogs and cats. Like, these were exotic animals. And it was like a rescue center as well. So, exactly. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And the lemurs are fast. And actually, I remember helping a friend with the mongoose. There were mongoose there, and they were target training them because they needed to individually crate them for like medical procedures and stuff. So they wanted to have one go to a target while they crated the other. So we were just working on individual targets. So like, this one went to this target and this one went to this one. And they were so quick. The skill was getting your reinforcement in fast enough before they just started moving again. They just were constantly moving. So I remember that really vividly. I think I only helped with that for a day or two, but.
Talking about immediate reinforcement. I don't think I can click that fast.
Really fast. Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, lots of good experiences there.
Cool. So what are you doing now?
So now I am a dog trainer, behavior consultant. Before COVID, I mostly went into people's homes and helped them with problems they were having with their dogs. And that could be anything from potty training and jumping to maybe some aggressive behavior with another dog or with a family member or visitors, things like that. And now I'm primarily doing that via Zoom. And it's great. It's going really well. So there's a lot of perks to it. But my job is to coach the client on doing the training. So I go in and I kind of figure out what's going on. We make a plan together that's going to work for them and their dog. And then I help them through the steps of the training. So I don't actually do a lot of dog training. I more do client training. And I always love, like, usually about the second session, people will say, "Oh, it seems like you're really training me." Like, yep, exactly. Because
light bulbs.
They have to maintain the behavior. You know, they're the ones that they have to understand how it works and how it got there so they can maintain it, because they're the ones living with their dog. And, you know, it's funny. We kind of joke that, like, our jobs as dog trainers is just to make ourselves useless, right? So, like, my goal is that my client can be independent and doesn't need to rely on me for their whole life of their dog.
Yeah, it's our underlying thought as behavior analysts is to work ourselves out of a job because everybody thinks like we do. We all see the world in these contingencies and, you know, patterns of reinforcement.
If that ever happens, it'll be a good day. All of us behavior analysts will just go to the beach, right?
Yes. Socially distanced beaching, all of us.
Yes. Yes.
So training, which I think it's really funny because so many of us now have realized direct care, you know, is as much as we try to pull ourselves out, we end up like, that's just part of what we do. Like, I still want to work with my kids, or I still want to work with the adults, or, you know, you still want to work with the animal. But in the long run, it really comes down to who's with that person or entity more often. And are they going to be able to maintain? Because I know Mocha was the dog of choice for a while in grad school. None of her behaviors maintained with me or generalized. So fun things that you have done in your career. So you've worked with lemurs and mongoose, mongeese, Rikki Tikki tabbies is how I know them. It's my first thought. But what other, or have there been any other, like, unusual clients that have stuck out to you?
I have to say, since I've graduated and been working professionally, I've had a couple of clients where the cat was involved, because we were working on, like, dog and cat interactions and getting them comfortable with each other. But like mostly work with dogs. Yeah. What's that?
So it's like sibling training.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I've done some of that. Let's see, most interesting cases. Okay, so one of my more recent interests is, and this is something that's becoming more and more common in animal training, and zoos have been doing it for a long time, but it's starting to come to pet training. And that's the idea that we're able to teach our animals to cooperate for veterinary care and husbandry. And so it's, instead of holding them down and doing the injection, can we ask them to station and hold still? And can we do some training so that that whole experience is more comfortable for everyone? And so that's something that's really captivated me in the last few years. And I've had a few clients in that area. And I think one of the big wins was a client I was working with. I think we worked together for probably maybe 4 months or 6 months on, you know, every few weeks we got together and practiced, and we were working on getting her dog comfortable for a blood draw. He hadn't had a blood draw in a couple of years. He's a really big Ridgeback. And he never showed any aggressive behavior, but the vet, you know, if she tried to do the exam or injections or anything, he would just fly off the table and hide in the corner. Like, he was so upset. So we practiced first, just, can you get on the table by yourself? And then we did a lot of stationing where he was on the table and focused on his handler, his owner, while I pretended to be the veterinarian, and I practiced touching him in different places, and we worked it up slowly with lots of positive reinforcement along the way. And they, with the help of medication as well, they were able to get the blood draw. So that I think is one of my more standout cases. I'm really proud of it. And the owner was so dedicated in her practice, and it was a nice team effort with the veterinarian too. So that was cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
It's so tough because Mocha is old and grumpy now. And so the vet is not her favorite place. She likes to go for pets, but she's not one, like, as soon as they start to look at her paws or they want to touch her feet, just nope, we're not okay with it. And we've spent the last 12 years working on even just being okay with nail trims, and it's still a struggle. Yeah. So that's so cool. And Ridgeback, that's a big boy.
He was really big. And his owner was not big. She's a tiny lady. And yeah, so, you know, I mean, you never want to use force in that situation if you don't have to, but like, I don't know that we even could have. And that was really, yeah, was part of what made it an interesting case to me.
Yeah.
So big. We've got to get him involved, right? So, yeah.
Because he's going to rule anyway. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. So what are some of like the top, I don't know, not even top, like what are some of the lessons that you have learned either through things that you feel you did well and you're like, heck yes, that just reinforced the heck out of my behavior, or that you're like, oh, I look back on that now and I would have done things so differently?
Sure. That's a great question. So we'll start with the non-examples. When I first graduated, you know, our degree is very technical and we're very particular about the way we do things. And I had sort of, during that time, I was so focused on behavior analysis and my degree that I really had lost touch with the like pet dog owner side of things and their perspective and where they're coming from. And so my first couple of clients, I showed up and I started explaining everything about positive reinforcement and what punishment is and what positive reinforcement is and shaping. And I think I just overwhelmed them with information. And that is something I've learned to do differently. And you know, they were really great people, and we did make progress with their dogs, despite my maybe overwhelming them with science approach. But yeah, I kind of came on a little strong with the technical side of things. And it took me a while to learn how to talk to clients so that they can learn enough about the science that they understand it well enough to implement it without overwhelming them. And that can be different for each person. So that always, when I have a new client, that's always something I'm trying to feel out, is how much of the technical side of things is this person going to want? And how do I keep from overwhelming them and making this aversive so that they just shut down? Like, I don't want to shut people down with that. So yeah, that's a lesson I've learned. And then, as far as things that have worked, something that I have, you know, as behavior analysts, data is one of our huge, a huge tool for us, is taking our data. And I have worked really hard for this, you know, past, gosh, it's been like almost 10 years since I graduated, which is unbelievable. But we've been working, I've been working on, how can I get clients to take data that's useful to me without it being something they hate? and again, that's going to depend on each individual client. But I think that that's something that I'm starting to learn how to do better, and getting some success with getting clients to take really useful data. So this most recent client is working on potty training their dog, who's they live in an apartment now, and she came from a house in the suburbs. So it's quite a different living environment. And so, but they, you know, came to me with a potty log that they had been keeping. And I was so happy that they initiated it. And I found that if you can somehow get the client to initiate the data, that is most likely to be successful. And so then we talked about like, okay, you've already started. That's awesome. Please keep taking this. What can we tweak to make it more useful to us? And then the other thing I've started doing is they take the raw data and then I put it in a graph and show it to them each week. And they love that. So that has been reinforcing for them and for me. And so we've got really good data on this most recent client. And that's something that in the past I've really struggled with. So I think that's
one of the top things. If we could teach ourselves to teach other people the value of data without doing like you said, because I'm the same way. Like, I'm going to beat you to death with the thing that I love. Like, you will love behavior analysis. You will love this science. And people are like, no, please don't. Because my approach is totally wrong. Whereas if I go in now, or like, as we've learned, like I go in a little bit more soft, a little more compassion, and I kind of feel things out first, like how much can you handle? Yeah, a lot more success happens. And I think anecdotally, I find that I tend to make progress faster that way, as opposed to let me beat you down with the science. You're, you know, frustrated. We get this counter control thing going on. And then we finally come to amends sometime later. And the poor dog or human is still kind of in the middle going, but what about me?
Exactly.
Yes. So, which leads me, I was wondering, so when you do your intakes, what kind of questions do you ask?
Sure. So I want to know, and I have a form that I have people fill out ahead of time. And I want to know, you know, it depends on the issue. I have some specific questions about what behaviors are most concerning to you and what happens before and after those behaviors. And so I'm kind of hinting at like what antecedents should we be looking at and what consequences should we be looking at. And some other questions I've learned that are important to ask are just, I have a list of behaviors that are common to see. And I just say, check if your dog does any of these, because I was noticing that people would call me for one problem and we'd start working on that. And then I get there and they're like, and my dog does this, this, and this. And then it's a lot more extensive than we had originally planned. So it just helps me get a full scope from the beginning. Like, does your dog dig? Do they chew on things? Are they friendly with people and dogs? Things like that. And, you know, anytime it's an aggression case, I want to know about what that looks like, just to keep everybody safe. So, you know, if your dog is afraid of people, like, what do they typically do? What do you do to prevent, you know, to keep people safe typically? And should we, especially when I'm going into your home, what should we do to set up so that everyone can be safe? Which is actually really another benefit of Zoom, is for dogs that are worried about people, it's a lot less stressful for them. So that's probably something I'll keep doing for those types of clients for a long time. But yeah, so I just want to have as good of scope as I can about like, what is the extent of what's going on here? I want to know what people have tried, because a lot of times when clients come to me, they've been dealing with a problem for years sometimes, and it's likely that they've tried a lot of things, and that often means that this behavior now has multiple functions. And so we need to understand all of them in order to address them.
So what are like the common areas of concern that people come to you with?
I think the number one is still, this has been the trend since I've been doing this, is dogs who bark, lunge, or pull on a leash when they see other people or other dogs. And in animal training, we kind of label that as reactivity. It's like a catch-all term that could mean all sorts of different things. But that is the number one, probably. And then in the last 6 months, I've had a lot of puppy clients. That's another thing we've talked about in our industry, is that when the pandemic happened, a lot of people were home that weren't before, and people who had always wanted to have a puppy but didn't think they had the time to raise one decided to get a puppy. So there's been this huge increase in puppy parents, and they're so a lot of typical puppy issues, which includes like inappropriate chewing. Puppies love to use their mouths, and that's how they explore the world, and that's sort of normal dog behavior, but they don't always have the training to do that appropriately. So teaching them to put their mouths on toys instead of people is a big one. Potty training, and then just general like leash walking skills, even before there's a problem with pulling and lunging and barking at other dogs. That's something that has been really popular lately.
I was going to ask what changes happened, because I know with the pandemic and everything, because yeah, there was definitely the influx of pet adoptions, which was greatness. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of friends that do fostering for dogs. So that's kind of funny that you mentioned the puppy mouthing, because the most recent one was a big baby. I mean, he was very tall, but very young. And he was cuddling on me, and he was doing the little puppy nipples down my arm. And I'm like, oh, honey, you're so little, but you're so big. And so if someone didn't know how young he was, that would be their first thing. Oh, he's biting. No, he's not. He's a big, dumb baby. So like you said, that's how he's exploring the world.
It's so hard to remember when you have a large breed that they're still young. It's really hard. Yeah.
So what other changes did you guys see during the pandemic? Like, you know, did everybody go immediately to telehealth, or was it?
Well, I would say the first 2 months, it was, for me, I had nothing. It was like everything stopped for a couple of months. And I think it just took everyone some time to understand, well, first of all, that Zoom training is possible and effective. I think locally, a lot of my clients were a little skeptical about that. So I had some active clients that I'd been seeing in person, and it was so sudden and abrupt. And it was like one day I was seeing them and the next week I wasn't. And so for some of them, we did do Zoom right away, just because I couldn't just drop them, right? So to finish out, we did do Zoom right away. Some people waited until the summer, and then last summer we were able to do some outdoor sessions to kind of catch up. But I noticed probably around August was when people were really getting on board with Zoom locally around here. I think it was different for different people around the area, but by August, I think everyone kind of realized like, things are going to be this way for a while. And now I have a 6-month-old puppy that I got in March that's biting me, and I can't wait. And it took some time, and it took some time for me to figure out, you know, the best ways to work that way too. So I kind of do a combination of having people submit videos of their practice sessions, and then sometimes we do live, like they'll train their dog on camera. So it just depends on what we're working on and what their client is comfortable with. So, yeah.
All right, quick interruption for those who are listening for CEs. This is the first of your two key words. Your first word is target, T-A-R-G-E-T, hitting a target.
That's really cool. Yeah. What about like, do you do any video modeling that you then send to them to show what you would like to see from them?
Yes, I do. And actually, I had been experimenting with that a little bit before the pandemic. So I was lucky because I had been taking videos of other people's dogs for several years. I had been working on just developing some, you know, this is, you'll like this. So in at UNT, we were doing those experiments with flipping the classroom, where we had, you know, video lectures, and then the students were doing all of the hands-on stuff in class. And I have had this idea to try that with my group classes, because when people come and their dog, you know, it's such an intense environment, a group class. So there's six dogs in a room and they've never met each other before. And the people have never done any training before. And so sometimes it can feel a little chaotic and stressful. And I just want to get that a little smoother. So I had been experimenting with sending videos ahead of time and having them practice the material at home for a week. And then it's not brand new when they come to class. Anyway, I'd been building a library of videos for that purpose. So I was lucky that I had that. And I was able to use that from the beginning. And I think it's really valuable for people. One thing I was trying to do when I was accumulating that video library is I was purposefully looking for dogs that were not mine, that maybe either had, you know, unwanted behavior in a certain scenario, or they hadn't learned this skill yet, so that it was more authentic. Because I think, you know, showing a demo with my dog Doug, it's useful to show the mechanics of things, but I think it's more helpful for people to see it with a puppy that's had no training. Because things come up that are going to be more similar to what they're experiencing. So I do use demo videos a lot, and I think it's really helpful.
That's awesome. Okay, yeah. So you mentioned Doug. So what are you and Doug and Dan all doing now? What are you guys working on?
Yeah, my latest, so I have my, like, you know, they say, like, if you do what you love, you'll work all the time or something like that, right? Isn't that the saying, right?
do what you love, do work what you love. I don't know.
You'll never work or you'll work all the time. And it's both, right?
Someone's going to comment.
Yeah. So happy. So anyway, my hobbies are also dog training. And I try to choose things that are not the same as what I'm doing for work, because I love training and I love building on my own training skills and learning more about dog training, but I need to have it be a little bit separate. So my husband jokes, because he's like, all you do is dogs. I'm like, no, this is different dog stuff, right? This is my hobby dog stuff. It doesn't count as work. My latest interest is nose work. And so that's the idea of teaching your dog to search for a specific scent and then indicate to you somehow with their behavior that they have found it. And actually there's competitions for it. And typically the scents that are used are essential oils. So birch oil and cypress oil and anise, and different levels use different scents. So you start out with birch oil and it's dropped on a little Q-tip, and you hide that in a tin and you hide it somewhere in a room, and then your dog has to find it. And in the competitions, you as the handler don't know where it is. So it's blind. And when your dog finds it, you have to tell the judge, you say alert to tell the judge that the dog has found it. And if you're right, you pass. That's how the competitions work. And I've been doing this just for fun at home with both of my dogs for a long time. And it's a fun sport because there's the training aspect to it, but then there's also learning about how the odor works in the environment. So there's some, you know, physics there about, like, how does it move and how can you set up a search so that it's the right level of challenge, which is tricky because we can't see it. So it's invisible to us. So, but you can think of odor moves through the environment a lot, like liquid does, it flows, and so, or smoke, you know, if you can envision smoke moving through the environment, odor looks the same to our dogs. So it's not gonna, you know, moves the same way. Right. And actually I have a few clients who are interested in learning, and we've been doing weekly Zoom nose work meetups since the pandemic began. And that's helped me stay motivated to keep practicing. So we get together and share our videos once a week. It's really fun.
That's super rad.
Yeah.
Even thinking about with everything that's been going on with the pandemic, I've seen a few articles come out now with dogs that are being trained to sniff out the coronavirus and its variants. And then even from there, I think Parkinson's has been looked at. I know seizures and epilepsy. I think that there's some smell, and it's fascinating to me. And just how many olfactory senses the dog has versus ours. Like you said, like they see it almost. I'm like, oh, it's such a cool visual. Yeah. And again, then I look at Mocha and I go, she's not a real dog because she doesn't find things. She's nose blind.
Oh
yeah, she's old. It's fine. But so when you're working with them, because I know I've watched your videos and everything, and they look so engaged and they look so happy while they're doing it. What other ways do you know that they're enjoying their training time with you? Because every time I talk to a dog trainer, they're like, oh, I just know. And everyone has their thing.
That's a great question. And in animal training, that's something, in any training, honestly, anytime you're changing behavior, you want the person whose behavior you're changing or the learner's whose behavior you're changing to be enjoying it. And you want it to be a good experience, right? So, one way is that they choose to approach when it's training time. So, when I pick up my dog treats and my clicker, they start running between me and the area that we usually do a lot of our training in. Kind of like if you pick up the leash when you're going to take your dog on a walk, right? I see that same level of enthusiasm. And, when we're thinking about how do our dogs feel, we use a lot of body language as indicators. So we can look at their ears and their mouths and their tail and their posture, and all of those things can tell us, are they comfortable or uncomfortable? Their enthusiasm, it's really obvious to me that they're very excited to go. Some animal trainers will they make sure that their dog has a way to opt out of training sessions. And if they ever choose to leave, you're done. So, and that's a pretty good indicator that if your dog walks away from you, then they're probably not enjoying this. Or at least something else is better than this, right? They're choosing a different activity or different reinforcer they're getting somehow. I think, I try not to use a leash when I first start training and things like that. I let them have the freedom to move around. That's another way to pay attention to that. But yeah, I work really hard to keep the training session successful so that they're getting a high rate of reinforcement. And I'm always thinking about making my criteria small enough that they can find success. And I think that also helps keep them engaged and keeps it positive. So
it's just fun because having worked with the human side of things now, I'm like, yep, cool. Yep, behavior analysis still works across all the things. Just glad to have that reminder. All organisms behave, and pretty similarly too.
Yes.
Yes. So one of the questions that I wanted to ask you was, in the world of especially in schools and education, ASD, IDD, there's a lot of fun acronyms that get discussed and debated, and I feel like people, prefer to be, I do precision teaching, or we use discrete trial training, or NET, or, there's again, lots of acronyms. But that's in this side of behavior analysis. In the animal side, do you guys have similar debates and discussions?
Absolutely. Yes. So I would say, especially in the area of reactivity and aggression, there are several different, we would call them training packages or something like that. Systems that people have developed that are, have steps that you follow. They're programs. And yes, there are people who are like, oh, well, I do bat and I do cat and I do control unleashed. And absolutely there's debate all the time about which is better. I like to learn about all of them because really, if we're thinking about it from a behavior analytic point of view, it should be individualized to the situation. And yeah, they do all work. And it is really similar. So I think they're all effective in the right context. And but I think it is helpful for people to have a program to follow, especially beginning trainers. So I think it's a good thing, but I am always trying to understand, like, okay, well, in Control Unleashed, they do this, and that's the same as this somewhere else. And it's all really just shaping through negative reinforcement or something like that, right? So can we boil it down to the science? So that's probably one of the main the main things that people debate about. There's a lot of debate in animal training, and I don't know if this extends to other parts of behavior analysis, but a big topic is the ethics of what procedures we're using and implementing. And, a lot of people consider negative reinforcement to be less ethical than using positive reinforcement, because there's more likely to be coercion involved in that. And so I think that's been something that there's been a lot of debate around over the last few years too. And I think it's really pushing us to be better at using positive reinforcement whenever we can. And I think that's a really good thing. So Dr. Susan Friedman's a behavior analyst who does a lot of animal training, and she teaches animal trainers a lot. She has a course called LLA, which is Living and Learning with Animals. And it's essentially an introduction to behavior analysis for animal trainers. It's a really fantastic course. But she's developed the humane hierarchy. And so it's a process for going through least intrusive, most effective, minimally aversive, whichever acronym you're using, same idea. And it's a structure for thinking through which procedures you're using so that you're most likely to use the more ethical ones first. So start with antecedent arrangement and positive reinforcement, and you really shouldn't get to using punishment unless, that should be really rare. And so she has guidelines for that, which I think is really cool. But there's been a lot of debate around that, and there's a lot of controversy about, like, oh, well, you use punishment, and then, well, oh, well, but there's punishment all around us all the time, and so I don't know. But I think it's pushing us forward and helping us to be really critically thinking about what we're doing to another organism, right? Because when we're changing someone's behavior, it's something we're doing to them, and so I don't know. I think that's a good thing.
And like the potential butterfly effect that happens, if you impact or you teach a dog owner one way, then they're going to go and tell their friends, and you're going to see that kind of flow out that direction. And if someone is misinformation, then you can see, the detrimental effects of that, how it flows down. But I think that's so cool, because I haven't even, it's things that like have crossed my mind in passing about ethically treating, because, my dog is my child. But I know that other people don't view their animals that way, which is shocking to me. They're just pets. They're not just pets, but it is, and it's a value standard. But to actually, I think, write that out is phenomenal, because for humans, we've done that. To really kind of shift focus to other organisms, since I think as science in general and technology progresses, we're starting to realize that these, the factoids that we were originally taught, like, oh, well, animals aren't really that cognizant, they don't show empathy. And all of a sudden it's like, oh snap, they actually really do. We just didn't have a way to measure it. The behavior was still there, but we just didn't have the measurement tool. And now we're starting to find the measurement tools. So to bring it back to, like, even though it is, an animal, it's still an organism, and it still deserves to be treated in a humane way.
Absolutely.
So absolutely. That's so cool. Oh, so with like your verbal community and everything, so what do you do to keep yourself engaged with other animal trainers to, expand yourself professionally, to continue?
Sure. Yeah. Continue education. Well, because my background is behavior analysis, it's really important to me to maintain that education as well as staying in the loop with what animal trainers who have different backgrounds are doing. And a lot of that is because I want to know what my clients might find on the internet before they call me. That's the practical application there. And that's another thing that I've kind of developed over time. In UNT, it was pretty much expected of us that we would go to ABBA each year. And I think that was fantastic. And because of that, all my friends still go. So I still go. So I go to ABBA every year. And I think that is critical for staying in touch with the science. So I'm not a BCBA, but I still go. And I think it's really important to do that as much as I can. And then the fact that all my friends still go makes it really fun and reinforcing for me. So, and I think we kind of hold each other accountable. We still share a room like we did in grad school, and it's really fun. So anyway, I think that helps me stay in touch with what's happening in behavior analysis, and even going to talk, you know, there's not a lot of animal talks at ABBA, and actually most of the animal talks I've usually seen somewhere else throughout the year. So I usually go to other things, and it's cool to see what other people are doing to apply the science, and then how can I bring that back? So ABBA for sure. And then there's animal training conferences too. There's Clicker Expo is one of them. And I don't go to that every year, but I would say every few years I try and participate. And that one's really about hands-on, the application of, it started out as mostly clicker training, although now, you know, it's branching out into other topics too, that are more treatment focused rather than building particular behaviors and shaping. And so that's one conference I do. And then I have started going to the Art and Science of Animal Training Conference at UNT again. And I find that to be a really nice bridge between the two, because they bring in behavior analysts and they bring in animal trainers who work hands-on with all different species. And so that's always a really cool conference. So those are the kind of the big things I do. And then just generally day-to-day, I have worked pretty hard to find like-minded colleagues that I can talk to. In animal training, you know, I work for myself by myself, and it feels really isolating if you don't do that. Yeah, I've got, and you know, I had that community in Oregon when I lived there, and now I've found that community in Michigan. And so it's cool because I've got some colleagues in Oregon that I can rely on, and here, and I have a few colleagues that I talk to really regularly, almost daily, and we'll touch base about what we're doing with each of our own clients and kind of kick ideas off of each other and help it. That's really helpful on a day-to-day basis.
So for a person, either someone who is a behavior analyst or even who's just, you know, looking at the field, what are your like top recommendations for exploring the world of animal training in behavior?
Sure. So I think if you already have the behavior analysis background, a lot of what you know is, you probably already know a lot of what you need. I think the other half of animal training is getting to know the species you're working with. So I primarily work with dogs. I recently was trying to help a friend with her cat, and I realized how little I know about cats. So I was just doing this as a side thing. But I learned a lot about cats. and so just understanding like what biologically that species needs, what's important to them, what things may or may not be reinforcers, and then reading body language is huge in animal training. So understanding, like, you know, I remember at the Herd Museum learning about the macaw they had there would dilate her pupils when she, when we were too close to her. And I remember learning that that was sort of like a go away type of behavior, right? And it's almost an avoidance or escape. And I never would have known that. And if you don't know that, it's going to be really hard to change that animal's behavior. So I think if you, you know, whatever species you want to work with, it's important to find somebody who can teach you about that and go somewhere where you can get hands-on learning. So for dogs and cats, volunteering at a shelter is a really good place to start because you get exposure to a lot of different animals. And they, most shelters have a training process where they teach you how to safely handle the dogs and walk them, and they'll start out volunteers with the dogs that have already been screened and they're really safe and easy. And then you stick around and get to know, hopefully shelters are starting to have behaviorists on staff. And so if they do, buddy up with that person and ask them a lot of questions and ask to observe what they're doing. And that hands-on piece is really critical.
Quick pup date for your second keyword, which is smell. S-M-E-L-L. My dog doesn't smell.
What about certifications? Do you have any like credentialing? Is there any kind of like testing that you have to go through?
Yes. So animal training is an unregulated field. There's no requirement to be certified, but it's becoming more and more the general standard. I don't know yet if clients look for it or not, but other animal trainers definitely look for it amongst their colleagues. So we're pushing each other at least. There's several different certification programs. The most common is CCPDT. It's the Certification of Professional Dog Trainer, and that's the one I have. There's an hours requirement, like teaching hours with the client, and then there's a test that you have to take. I forget the acronyms. IAABC is another one, the International Association of Behavior Consultants, I believe. I don't have that one, but a lot of my colleagues do. And that one requires some case studies that you have to submit. So I would say it's a little more regimented, but it's similar in the sense that you have to have a certain number of hours. I don't remember if there's a test in addition to the case studies, but yes, there are certifications and they're really important. And I hope that they become more and more common. But,
so looking at like time-wise, we can kind of start to wrap up a little bit. So you've worked in 4-H, you've worked with dogs, you've learned a lot about cats and macaws and lemurs and mongooses. What's your number one, like this was the best moment ever, either with your own babies or with someone that you were working with?
I think with my clients, there's one that sticks out, and it was a different dog that was, we were working on cooperative care at the vet. And she, we had worked, this was one of my clients that the pandemic disrupted our work together. So we had been working together really regularly and made a lot of progress. And then the pandemic disrupted things and we were not able to continue. And then in August, she called me because she had just gone to the vet appointment and it went well and it was successful. And I think just her joy, I mean, that's the thing that I love the most is when my human clients find success and get that goal that they've been working towards, and then, and they're proud of themselves, you know, and it helped, they love their dog in that moment, which is cool. Like, I'm so proud of my dog that she was able to do this. So that was one of my best moments. And then with my own dogs, I think you know, we've done a lot of competitions and stuff, and the titles are fun and things like that. But I think the moments where, like, we're going on a hike together and life just feels easy together, that's my favorite thing. So, yeah. Yeah.
When everything's just smooth and lovely.
Yeah. Yeah. And we feel connected.
God, such a good feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
What animal, if any, like, you could have any animal in the world to work with, what would you work with?
Oh boy.
And what would you train it to do or shape or whatever?
Ooh, I've not thought about that. You know, I've never, this is so funny because this is like when I was in undergrad, so many people were like, I want to be a dolphin trainer. but I've never worked with a marine mammal. And I think that would be a really cool experience. What we teach, I'm not sure. It almost doesn't matter to me because I just think it would be interesting to have that experience. To me, it seems different because they're in the water and like sometimes you can't see them as well, I would think. I don't know. I think that would be really fun to learn. So.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. So since we are, you know, our little atypical alien podcast thing, sci-fi or fantasy?
Sci-fi.
Okay. Star Wars or Star Trek?
Star Wars.
All right. Overall favorite sci-fi character or series or whatever movie?
I love Donnie Darko. Does that count? That's such a good movie.
Oh, that counts across both. That's sci-fi, fantasy, headspace.
It's one of my favorite movies. Yes.
Yeah. I think that's one that, as a behavior analyst, you should go watch with a behavior analytic mindset and then without, and just to have some fun with your brain.
Absolutely.
What book would you recommend people maybe start with and then maybe a second book to follow up with?
Well, the classic in animal training is Karen Pryor's Don't Shoot the Dog. I think a lot of animal trainers got started because they read that book. So I think you can't miss that one. And then from there, I think it just depends on what you're looking for. One of my favorites is the Control Unleashed book. I mentioned that earlier, and I think that program is really interesting to me. It focuses a lot on back and forth communication is kind of how they frame it, but it's the dance, right, of behavior where your dog's behavior is cueing you and your behavior is cueing your dog. And so I think that's a really cool, cool book too.
Awesome. All right. So last minute plugs. If you want to give your website and other things that you're doing, that would be an amazing end to this lovely conversation we've had. I've learned so much.
Excellent. I've had a really good time. My website is lauraperkinsanimalbehavior.com. And I have a Facebook page by the same name. I have a blog on my website. And I'm hit or miss on whether I'm doing a lot of blogging. It just comes and goes, but there's a good library there. And then a friend of mine, Sarah Crockett, is another animal behavior consultant. And she's also interested in behavior applications for children, like for parents. She has a three-year-old son. She and I have been doing some video chats called Sips of Science. So you can check that out, sipsofscience.com.
Awesome. Yay. Well, thank you so much for jumping on with us and for being my guinea pig.
Absolutely.
Thank you immensely.
Thank you for listening to this adventure of the Atypical Behavior Analyst. Check out the website, atypicalba.com, for more episodes, references, and to purchase CEUs. To stay up to date, like and follow us on social media. Just search Atypical Behavior Analyst. If you like the show, please rate and leave us a review. And if you want to support the show but don't need CEUs, you can help by clicking the Buy Us a Coffee link in the show notes. So until next time, listeners, grab your towel, keep exploring, and we'll see you in the fringes.